He went to the Avis car rental counter in the airport concourse. The Avis girl gave him a sweet smile and allotted him a blue Volkswagen Golf. "I'm sorry. Without a reservation, that is all we have available." Before he left the car park, he stopped beside his dusty old Land Cruiser and surreptitiously transferred the shotgun wrapped in tarpaulin to the boot of the Volkswagen. Then he retrieved his Zeiss binoculars and slipped them into the cubbyhole. As he drove away, he checked that the Land Cruiser was tucked away at the furthest end of the crowded lot, where it would escape casual observation. He kept to the south side of the railway tracks and found his way through the streets of the business area to the open-air market that he had noticed during the earlier explorations of the town. At 10:30 in the morning, the market was crowded with vendors, displaying their wares and shoppers haggling over them. Dozens of trucks and minibuses thronged the area around it. They gave him cover. He parked the little blue Volkswagen amongst them, positioning her carefully. The market was on rising ground that overlooked the railway tracks and the light industrial area beyond. He found himself less than half a mile from the Chetty Singh warehouse and the Toyota workshops, so close that he could read the huge lettering of the company's signboard on the buildings with the naked eye. Through the 9-power lens of the Zeiss binoculars, he had a fine view of the front of the warehouse and the main doors. He could almost make out the expressions on the faces of the men working on the loading ramps. A regular stream of trucks passed in and out of the main warehouse gates. Amongst them he recognised the big pantechnicon and trailer. However, there was no sign yet of any police activity, and it was almost 40 minutes since he had made his phone call to them. "Come on, people, get the lead out!" he muttered impatiently. As he said it, he saw a shunting locomotive come puffing up the main line to the rail spur that entered the warehouse complex. It was running in reverse, the engine driver leaning out of his side window. As it approached, one of the warehouse guards swung open the mesh gate on the boundary fence, and the loco rolled through, slowing as it entered the open doors of the warehouse. It passed out of Daniel's sight, but seconds later he heard the faint but characteristic clash of steel as the coupling engaged. There was another delay, and then the loco re-emerged from the warehouse, drawing three trucks behind it. It gathered speed gradually as the heavily laden trucks gained momentum. The goods trucks were each covered by heavy-duty canvas covers. Daniel stared at them through the Zeiss binoculars, but could make out no definite indication that the tea-chests were under those covers. He lowered the binoculars and hammered his clenched fist against the steering wheel of the Volkswagen, and groaned aloud with frustration. Where the hell were the police? It was at least an hour and a half since he had phoned them. Even in his agitation, he realised that it would certainly take them longer than that to obtain a search warrant. "Ah, it just has to be the ivory," he muttered to himself. There was no other outbound cargo stacked on that ramp. It's the ivory, I'd take any odds, and it's on its way to Taiwan. The loco was drawing the three trucks sedately down the curving rail spur towards the main line and the goods yards, but it had to pass very close to where Daniel was parked on the outskirts of the marketplace. He started the Volkswagen and pulled out into the main road. He accelerated, passing a heavily laden lorry, and sped down to the level crossing which the loco must cross to reach the main goods yard. The red warning lights were flashing, the warning bell trilling, and the swinging barrier came down in front of him to guard the crossing, forcing him to brake to a halt. The loco rumbled slowly over the crossing directly in front of the stationary Volkswagen, moving not much above walking speed. Daniel pulled on the handbrake, and leaving the engine running, jumped down into the road and slipped under the barrier. The first truck rolled past, close enough to touch. The railway's consignment card was clipped into the holder on the side of the truck, and he read it easily as it came level and passed slowly in front of him. Consignee, Lucky Dragon Investment Company. Destination, Taiwan via Beira. Cargo, 250 cases of tea. The last lingering doubt was dispelled. Daniel stared angrily after the departing train. They were going to get away with it. They were going to get away with it right under his nose. The warning lights switched off, the bell fell silent, and the barrier began to rise as the loco and its rolling stock pulled away. Immediately, the drivers of the traffic backed up behind the Volkswagen, began to sound their horns and flash their lights impatiently. Daniel strode back to the car and drove on. He took the first road to the left, running parallel to the railway tracks, and found another place to park from where he had a view into the railway goods yard. He watched through the binoculars as the three trucks were shunted and coupled onto the end of a long goods train. The caboose was locked on behind them, and finally the whole assembly of coaches and goods trucks pulled out of the yard. With a green mainline loco pulling them, it set off for Mozambique and the port of Beira, 500 miles away on the seaboard of the Indian Ocean. There was nothing he could do to stop it happening. Wild fantasies flashed through his mind, of trying to hijack the loco, of rushing down to police headquarters and demanding that they take immediate action before it was too late and the train crossed the border. Instead, he drove back to his original vantage point beside the open-air market and resumed his vigil through the binoculars. He felt tired and dispirited and remembered that he had not slept at all the previous night. His arm was stiff and sore. He unwrapped the bandage and was relieved to see that there were no further obvious signs of infection. On the contrary, the rips in his forearm were beginning to scab over as well as he could have hoped for. He replaced the bandage. While he watched the warehouse, he tried to work out some means of stopping the ivory shipment. But he knew that his hands were tied. In the end, it all came down to the death of Chawe. Chetty Singh had only to point at him, and he stood accused of murder. He dared not draw official attention to himself. While he waited and watched, he thought about Johnny Inzu and Mavis and their children, mourning them and nursing his hatred for their murderers. Almost 2 hours after the goods train had left, he noticed sudden activity around the warehouse. Chetty Singh's green Cadillac drew up at the main gates, followed by two grey-painted police Land Rovers, each filled with uniformed constables. There was a short discussion with the guards at the gate, then the three vehicles drove into the property and parked beside the open warehouse doors. 11 police constables, led by an officer, climbed out of the Land Rovers. The officer spoke briefly to Chetty Singh beside the Cadillac. Through the binoculars, Daniel saw that the Sikh appeared dapper and unconcerned. His turban was crisp and white above his darkly handsome face. The police officer led his men into the warehouse, only to emerge again an hour later, strolling along at Chetty Singh's side. The officer was gesticulating and talking persuasively, very obviously apologising to Chetty Singh, who smiled and waved away his protestations and finally shook his hand magnanimously. The contingent of police constables reboarded their Land Rovers and drove away. Standing beside the green Cadillac, Chetty Singh watched them go, and it seemed to Daniel through the binocular lens that he was no longer smiling. "Bastard," Daniel whispered. "You haven't got away with it yet." He finally got control of his anger and started to think rationally once again. Could he stop the shipment before it left the country, he wondered, and almost immediately he abandoned the idea. He knew that the goods train was on a non-stop run and would reach the border within hours. What about intercepting it at the port of Beira before it was loaded on a tramp steamer bound for the Far East? This was a better bet, but still long odds. From what little he had learned about Chetty Singh so far, it was clear that he had a network of influence and bribery that extended over many countries in Central Africa, certainly over Zimbabwe and Zambia, and why not over Mozambique, one of the most corrupt and chaotic states on the continent. He was certain that a great deal of contraband passed through the warehouse over there, and Chetty Singh would have secured his pipeline to the outside world. As Malawi was a landlocked state, that pipeline must include the port captain and the Mozambican army, police force and customs service. They would be paid off by Chetty Singh and would protect him. Still, he decided, it was worth a try. Daniel drove down to the main post office in the town centre. It was highly unlikely that the Malawi police had the sophisticated equipment to trace a telephone call swiftly, but once again he took the precaution of making his message short and of muffling his voice with a handkerchief and speaking in Swahili. "Tell Inspector Mapolo that the stolen ivory was shipped out of the warehouse at 11:35 a.m. by goods train to Beira. It is hidden in a shipment of tea chests consigned to Lucky Dragon Investment Company in Taipei. Before the operator on the police exchange could ask for his name, he cradled the receiver and crossed to a small general dealer's store on the opposite side of the street. If the police weren't going to do anything, it was all up to him. He purchased a packet of safety matches, a roll of sellotape, a box of mosquito coils, and 2 kilos of frozen minced meat, then drove back to the Capital Hotel. As soon as he entered his hotel room, he was aware that somebody had searched it. When he opened his canvas valise, he saw that the contents had been disarranged. "Nothing for Chetty Singh there," he muttered with grim satisfaction. He had deposited his passport and traveller's cheques in the hotel safe at the cashier's desk downstairs, but the search of his possessions confirmed his estimate of Chetty Singh. "Now, he's not only a tough bastard, but a cunning one. He's organised, and he hasn't missed a trick so far. Let's see if we can spoil his record. But first I need some shut-eye." He changed the dressing on his arm and gave himself another shot of antibiotic, and then fell on the bed. He slept until dinner time, then showered and changed. He felt refreshed and more cheerful. His arm was less painful and the stiffness had eased. It seemed that his mind had been busy even while he slept, for the details of his plan were clear as he sat down at the writing desk and laid his small purchases out in front of him. He lit one end of a mosquito coil and left it smouldering as he worked, timing the rate at which it burned. Using his clasp knife, he snipped the heads off the safety matches. He used up the entire package of matches and discarded the decapitated sticks in the waste paper bin. He stuffed the match heads back into the paper wrapping and taped it all up. It made a neat package the size of a fist, a very functional little incendiary bomb. He checked the burning rate of the mosquito coil. It was approximately 2 inches per half hour. The acrid, insecticidal smoke made him sneeze, so he took the coil to the bathroom and flushed it down the toilet. He returned to the desk and cut 2 fresh coils, 5 inches long, to give a delay of a little over 1 hour. They were the time fuses of his makeshift bomb, one as a backup should the other fail. He pierced the paper packet of match heads, inserted the ends of the coils in the punctures, and taped them carefully in place. Then he went downstairs and stood himself a good dinner and a half a bottle of Chardonnay. After dinner, he checked Chetty Singh's residential address in the telephone directory and found the street in the town map provided so thoughtfully by the Lilongwe Chamber of Commerce. Then he went down to the Volkswagen in the hotel parking lot and drove through the almost deserted streets. He passed the lighted shop front of Chetty Singh's supermarket, then circled the block. In the alley behind the building, he noted the bags of garbage and empty cardboard boxes piled against the rear wall of the supermarket awaiting collection. He smiled with satisfaction as he noticed the smoke detector of the fire warning system high on the wall above the piles of garbage. From there he drove out to the airport. The Land Cruiser was now conspicuous in the almost deserted airport car park. He gave the attendant a 10 kwacha note and asked him to keep an eye on it. Then he opened the back doors of the truck and rummaged around in his medical box until he found the plastic canister of sleeping capsules. Parked under a street light, he opened the plastic bag of minced meat in his lap. By this time it had defrosted. With his thumbnail, he split open the sleeping capsules and poured the white powder over the meat. He used 50 capsules. That should be enough to stun a bull elephant, he decided with satisfaction, and thoroughly mixed the drug into the chopped meat. Then he drove out to Chetty Singh's home in the elite suburb behind the State House and the main government buildings. The house was the grandest on the street, set in 2 or 3 acres of lawns and flowering shrubs. He parked the Volkswagen further down the street in an unlit section and walked back along the sidewalk. As he came level with the fence surrounding Chetty Singh's property, 2 dark shapes detached themselves from the shadows and hurled themselves against the wire mesh. German Rottweilers, Daniel noted, as the 2 guard dogs clamoured for his blood. My least favourite animals after the hyena. On the other side of the fence, they kept pace with him as he followed the sidewalk to the end of the property. As he passed the gates at the entrance to the driveway, he noted that the padlock on the chain was of simple construction. 2 minutes' work with a paperclip. He left the two Rottweilers staring after him hungrily and turned the corner into an unlit side street. From his pocket he brought out the packet of doped mincemeat and divided it into two equal portions. Then he walked back the way he had come. The dogs were waiting for him. He tossed a portion of the meat over the fence, and one of the dogs sniffed it and then gulped it down. Then he threw the second portion to the other dog and watched while it was devoured. He returned to the Volkswagen and drove back into town. He parked a block away from the supermarket. Still sitting in the front seat, he lit the ends of the mosquito coils protruding from the packet of match heads. He blew on them gently to make sure they were burning evenly, then left the Volkswagen and sauntered down the alley behind the supermarket. It was dark and deserted. With barely a check in his stride, he dropped the incendiary bomb into one of the cardboard cartons that made up the pile of rubbish and sauntered out of the alley. Back in the Volkswagen, he checked the time. It was a few minutes before 10 o'clock. He drove back and parked 3 blocks away from Chetty Singh's home. He pulled on the black leather gloves. From under the driver's seat, he brought out the 12-gauge shotgun, still wrapped in its sheet of light tarpaulin. He broke down the weapon, made certain there were no fingerprints, then refitted the forestock to the double barrels. When he stepped out of the Volkswagen, he slipped the barrels down one leg of his trousers, while the breech and buttstock section he tucked under his leather jacket. The barrels in his pants hampered his gait, but it was better to limp a little than parade fully armed through the streets. He had no idea how often the police patrolled this area. He checked his pockets to make sure that he had the spare cartridges and Chawe's warehouse keys. Then he limped on one stiff leg towards the Sikh's house. There were no guard dogs to greet him when he reached the corner fence of the property, and neither of them appeared even when he whistled softly to them. The dosage of the drug he had given them might have put them out for good and all. At the gates to the driveway, it took him even less than the 2 minutes he had estimated to deal with the padlock. He left the gates wide open and moved quietly across the lawns, avoiding the crunching gravel of the driveway. Daniel was prepared for a challenge from a night watchman, even though Malawi was not as lawless and uncontrolled as Zambia. There might have been a guard. However, Chetty Singh seemed to place more faith in animals than in humans. No challenge came, and from the shelter of a spreading bougainvillea, he surveyed the main house. It was in low ranch house style, with large picture windows, most of which were curtained and lit. Occasionally he saw the shadows of the occupants flit across the curtains, and he could distinguish between the silhouettes of Mama Singh and her more sylph-like daughters. The double garage was attached to the main house. One of the doors stood open, and through it he made out the gleaming chrome work of the Cadillac. Chetty Singh was at home. Still standing in shadow, Daniel reassembled the shotgun and slipped 2 SSG cartridges into the breeches. At close range, they would almost cut a man in half. He closed the action and set the safety catch. Turning the dial of his wristwatch to catch the light from the windows, he read the luminous numerals. In something under 20 minutes, depending on the burning rate of the mosquito coils, the packet of match heads would explode into bright phosphorus flame. The garbage pile should turn with a heavy outpouring of smoke. Within seconds, the fire alarms would detect it. Daniel moved quickly across the open lawn, watching the windows of the house. The gravel crunched lightly under his feet, and then he was in the garage. He sensed for any outcry, and when none came, he checked the doors of the Cadillac. They were all locked. In the garage wall nearest the driver's side of the Cadillac, there was a door that obviously connected with the main house. Chetty Singh would have to come through that.